Let's start. So the plan for today is, okay, maybe I'll remind you where we are. So we were seeking a homomorphic expansion going from KTG to ATG, and I haven't finished explaining the terms, but I think I more or less explained what KTG is and what ATG is. An expansion would be a universal finite type invariant, so an invariant valued from, I'll have to explain a little more about it later, but for now, just think it's a universal finite type invariant, so a map from here to here, which maps k singular objects to their corresponding core diagrams plus higher order terms, okay? And homomorphic just means that it commutes with all operations. So this has unzip operations, this has unzip operations. Homomorphic means commutes with all of these. Okay? And, but you see, in I decided that instead of going more along the algebraic direction of explaining this statement better and better, I want to tell you one of the reasons why it is useful. So the first reason was just basically why not? Sort of that's a fancy way of saying why not. The second reason is what I want to talk about today, it's algebraic knot theory. And the third reason is what will lead to high algebra, and this is that it reducing proving the fundamental theorem to a certain, what I call, high algebra problem. But for now I want to talk about the second reason. And you know, if you want to place it in our usual grid locator map, so it's somehow back in topology again. So I had to add a new row to make a room for it. Okay? Anyway, here is the, here's what an algebraic topology, or here's what this reason would be. So, I guess the idea is a bit like algebraic topology. So, or the reason for the name algebraic topology is similar to the name algebraic topology. So in algebraic topology, you know, you, for example, let's restrict our attention to homology theory, okay? So you construct a certain invariant of spaces. The invariant is a topological space goes to, well, a certain thing called the homology of that topological space, okay? The invariant is useful in itself. So, you know, if you want to prove that a genus 1 surface is not homeomorphic to a genus 2 surface, one way to do it is to compute the homology and show that the homology here is different than the homology there. Okay? But that's sort of a very naive view of algebraic of homology theory. And what's much more interesting is that when you have operations between spaces, so for me, operation between spaces, or for this purpose, an operation between spaces will just mean a map between them, okay? When you have operations between spaces, you have a corresponding operation between their homologies, and this becomes the really key for the usefulness of algebraic topology. So, for example, you know, if you want to prove that the Brouwer fixed point theorem, okay? So the Brouwer fixed point theorem ends up being the statement, so after a little bit of topological manipulation, it ends up being the statement that there is no retract from the n plus 1 dimensional disk into the n sphere, meaning if you look at the standard embedding of the m sphere as the boundary, the n sphere as the boundary of the n dimensional, n plus one dimensional disk, then there is no map from the n plus one dimensional disk back to the n dimensional sphere, call it, I don't know what, phi, or no, r, because it's retract, which would make this diagram commutative. So this is a statement in topology. There exists no such map r, okay? And the whole power of algebraic topology comes from the fact that you can translate pictures and topological diagrams like this to algebraic diagrams. So you apply homology and you compute the homology of the sphere, it turns out to be Z. You compute the homology of the disk, it turns out to be zero. You compute the homology of this sphere, it turns out to be Z. Furthermore, homology assigns maps, algebraic maps, to topological maps. So you get a diagram like this of algebraic maps, where this is the identity, because that was the identity. And no such thing exists, clearly. You cannot map Z to Z going through zero. Okay? So the whole point of, or the whole power of algebraic topology comes from having not just invariants, but also maps between them somehow. Okay? So the idea is to have a similar picture for knot theory. It's similar, not quite the same. Okay? Now, let me give you three examples of problems in knot theory that could be solved or could be, I don't know, or solved or at least tackled, at least you could get information about these problems if you had an algebraic knot theory or if you had invariants with good algebraic properties. Okay? So, maybe I'll go in an order slightly different than the order of the handout. So I'll start with example two. Okay? So I'm now listing questions in knot theory, and then I'll show you how these questions could be helped by having an algebraic knot theory. Okay? So question number two will be to determine, the reason I'm putting it first is because in some sense it's the easiest. So determine the unknotting number of a knot. So what's the unknotting number of a knot? Well, we all know that if you have a knot and you are allowed to cross strands, then you can undo it, right? If you are allowed to, in the case of the trefoil, if I'm allowed to flip a crossing, I very quickly get to the unknot. If you have a complicated knot, you may have to flip more than once. And the unknotting number is the minimal number of crossings you need to flip so that you get the unknot. Now, it's a three-dimensional question. It's not a two-dimensional question. So I'm not saying in a given projection the minimal number of crossings you need to flip. I really mean it three-dimensionally. Okay, so how many times in R3 does a cross, do you need to flip a crossing? And it's actually sometimes different. So sometimes you get a picture for which it's more complicated to unknot if you just want to kind of, without moving the picture. Okay? But anyway, that's just an aside. So, okay. Second question, or maybe the first question, it takes a little more time to describe, so let me start. So determine, determine the so-called genus of a knot. So what's the genus of a knot? And I have to move sideways and spend, I don't know, 20 minutes, however long it will take, to define the genus of a knot. So first of all, there is a theorem which I will in a minute prove, okay? So theorem, every knot in R3 can, or S3, can be presented as the boundary of an oriented surface embedded in R3. And such a surface is called a Seifert surface for the knot. So Seifert surfaces are interesting for their own reasons. There are other things you can do with the Seifert surface. So, but I will not go into this, I'll just explain the definition. So one explanation is the picture in your handout. So if you look at the nice color picture, then that's a picture of a surface embedded in R3 and whose boundary is the figure 8 knot. Okay? Let me give you another example, or two more examples, so, and then prove the theorem. So example number one, the trefoil. So first let's do it incorrectly. So I want a surface whose boundary is the trefoil. An incorrect way to do it is as follows. Well, you look at these three bigons, here, 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 and you put a disc inside each one, and then you connect the three discs to each other with a, so you connect here with a twist. Okay, so is the picture clear? Right, if I have two discs and they come near each other, rather than just gluing them, I glue their boundaries after twisting the boundary. Okay? Well, I guess this is not flexible enough to really show, but the picture is clear. Okay? So that's definitely a surface whose boundary is the trefoil. The problem is that when I go from here to here, I twist, twist again, so when I go around the surface, I twist three times, so it's not an orientable surface. Okay, so if I start at the top side of the surface, when I go to here, I find myself on the bottom side, back again on the top side, here at the bottom side again, back side, so it's in fact a Mobius band. So it was a nice try, but it wouldn't work. Okay? And for the trefoil, here is the picture that does work. Well, instead of using these three disks, use this disk and the disk at infinity. So everything else. And again, if you don't like infinity, you can just well, let it go far, 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 and then bend and come back behind. And I believe the picture on the black and white handout shows just that. So the top picture on the black and white handout that I just gave, shows the Seifert surface for the trefoil drawn by Emily Radlmeier in 2003, or maybe four, I don't know. Okay. Anyway, so now the theorem says that this is general, that every knot is the boundary of a surface. So, proof. Well, you know what? Why don't I prove it following Emily? So, following the pictures drawn by Emily. So, let's start with the figure 8 dot. Oriented the way Emily orients it. Okay? No, not okay. And then the first step is to take the oriented smoothing of each crossing. So again, the plan is to get these disks. And what I'm going to do is, I'm just going to tell you how to get them. So the oriented smoothing at the crossing is, well, you take the crossing and you, well, remove it and replace it by a picture like this, except you make the choice that keeps the knot oriented. Okay, so had I done the other choice, I would have orientation conflicts. So one of the two choices preserves the orientation of the knot, and that's the choice that I want to do, to pick. So let's see, over here, it would be, I'm going in here and out here, so it goes like that. Over here, it will be this. Over here, it will be this. And over here, it will be, again, I come in this way and out that way, so it's that. Is this the same picture as Emily? Yes. Okay? So now I have a union of cycles in the plane. Okay? So these are the so-called Seifert. Well, since I removed all the crossings, all I have left is cycles. So these are the so-called Seifert cycles of the original diagram that we had. Okay? The next thing is to make it, well, the next step is not really necessary, but I think I'll follow Emily in doing it. So, is to make it a bit three-dimensional by, you know what, I'll skip the next step. So, Emily draws it, but I will not. So, she just multiplies it by an interval. So, you know, the whole thing looks like a ribbon or a band lying on its side on the plane. So, each cycle looks like my belt lying on the plane, okay? And then the only reason to do that is so that you can do different things at the top of the side of the ribbon and at the bottom of the ribbon, okay? So what you do is at the top of the ribbon, you connect any two cycles that come near each other at the smoothing with a twisted band just as here. So basically, well, so just you add a twisted band that goes like that. Okay? And then likewise here, you add a twisted band, and likewise, likewise, here and here, okay? So I got back at the top, I got back my original knot, but I still have the boundary at the bottom, and the boundary at the bottom, right, is still a union of cycles, and in fact it's the same union of cycles as before. So it looks something like this. Okay? So what you do is you so now you look, you approach it from the back and you just seal each of these cycles with a disc. So you glue a disc to each of these cycles, starting from the innermost cycle with a small disc, and then go to bigger cycles and put bigger discs behind them. Okay? So is the picture clear? Okay. So if the picture is clear, we are done. Or, you know, perhaps just a better way to look at it is you create this ciphered cycle picture, and then you put discs behind so that, well, to seal these cycles. Okay, so small discs for the small cycles, big discs that extend further back for the bigger cycles. Okay, and now we have these sort of nested discs that come, whose boundaries come near each other in various places, and in each of these places you add a twisted band. Okay? Good. Anyway, and I should have explained why the theorem is proven. Sorry, why this is always orientable. So it's orientable because each of these disks has a preferred orientation as given by its boundary. Because, well, the knot was oriented to start with, and I took the oriented smoothings, so these cycles come with orientations. So I suppose this cycle is oriented counterclockwise. This cycle is oriented, I guess, also counterclockwise. This cycle is oriented that way. And wait, something is wrong. Sorry. Okay, so this orients, this gives a preferred orientation for the disks. They are oriented so as to match the orientation of the boundary. Okay? Or, that with this preferred orientation for the discs, when I glue the bands, the bands can also be oriented. Okay? But I'm a bit confused. You know what, let's just check it, okay? So let's declare that when you have a disk, if it's oriented counterclockwise, I'm going to paint its upside white and its backside black. So if I have a disk oriented clockwise, I'll paint its black side, its front side, the fine side facing me black, and therefore the back side white. So for our disks, this will be white when looked at from above, this will be white when looked up from above, and this will be black when looked at from above. And now let's see that the ribbons make sense. So the ribbon here connects the inside of this disk to the, the top side of this disk. So the, right, so I'm trying to walk from the top of this disk on the ribbon. I come to the back side of the ribbon, which is again white. That's fine. Okay? And over here, when I put the ribbons, I'm going from black to the back side of this disk, so it's again black. So the ribbons connect like colored sides. Okay, good. Sorry, so I had a little bit of a problem between nested disks and disks that are external to each other, but it actually does work. Anyway, okay. So, theorem, I'm sure you know that every two-dimensional surface oriented, I suppose also compact and connected surface is one of the sphere, the torus, the two-hole torus, and so on, where the number of hole is called the genus. So this will be a genus 2 surface. Okay, so that's a theorem from topology, which I'm not showing. Okay? If you're allowing a boundary, then, so this is without boundary, and if you're allowing one boundary component, so with one boundary component, the sequence becomes, just what you get from Z's by drilling one hole, okay? So it's a sphere with a boundary, or a torus with a disk boundary, or a two-hole torus, again with a disk boundary, and again the genus is the number of holes. So this will be a genus 2 surface. Okay? Now, since we just created the surface with a circle boundary, out of our knot. So topologically, it must be one of those. And I'd like to warn you that it's topologically one of those, and not as an embedded surface in R3. Okay? So let me give you an example. So here is another picture for the ciphered surface of the trefoil. So you take three twisted bands, and use them to connect two disks. So here is one disk, here is another disk, and they are connected with three twisted bands. You can check it's even more obvious now. Anyway, you can check that this is the trefoil knot. The boundary of this is the trefoil knot. So therefore, it must be one of these surfaces. And well, you know, if you look at it, it's not at all obvious which one it is. Okay. Now, it's only as a topological space homeomorphic to one of those, clearly not as something embedded, because all of these are embedded in R3, so that their boundary is the unknot. Okay? So we cannot expect, but since the boundary here is knotted, it cannot be one of these embeddings. Okay? So it's, by the way, entertaining to try to find which of these surfaces this particular one is. Okay? So maybe I'll do it in a cheating way. Okay? So Euler's theorem says that if you write any one of these surfaces, if you subdivide it into polygons and you write it as a union of polygonal pieces, okay, then the number of vertices minus the number of edges plus the number of faces, this is generally called the Euler characteristic of the surface, and again these are vertices, edges, and faces. So this is equal to 2 minus 2g minus, I believe, the number of boundary components, the number of holes or disks missing. So minus the number of boundary components. Okay? So if you use this theorem for this surface, well, let's use it. So I guess I need to write it as a union of polygonal pieces. It's actually not too hard. All I need to do is to cut each of the bands, and then to the right I have a polygon, right? It's a polygon with, let's see how many edges. Well, let's start here. So one edge going all the way to here, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 edges. So this is actually a hexagon. For the purpose of Euler's theorem, it's irrelevant. I just need to know the total number of edges, but just to orient yourself, I won't, you know, this is a hexagon. On the other side, well, again, I have a hexagon, only that sort of the little sort of bands that come out of it are a little longer, okay? So this is again a hexagon, and the two hexagons are glued to each other in a certain way, and now I can just do the counting. So V is equal to the number of vertices. Well, I have two vertices for each edge, so it's 6. The number of edges is equal to 1, 2, 3. The number of faces is equal to 2, because I have two hexagons. So the Euler characteristic is equal to 6 minus 3 plus 2. Oh my God.
No, you have a lot more edges.
I have a lot more edges. I forgot all of those. You're right. Sorry. So I did need to know how many edges I had. Sorry. So the number of edges is also all the other boundary pieces. These are also edges. Okay? So the number of edges is, in fact, 6 from here plus 6 from here, but cancel 3. So that's 9. Oh, now it's better. Anyway, 6 minus 9, that's negative 3 plus 2, it's negative 1. Negative 1, right? That's supposed to be equal to 2 minus 2g minus 1 boundary component. So 2 minus 2g is equal to 0, so g is equal to 1. So this is supposed to be a genus 1 surface. So topologically, this is equal to that. And well, first of all, we've answered, well, I told you that I told you what was the genus of the surface, but again, it's a bit hard to see that this really is a surface of genus 1. Okay, so if you want a little exercise, really see. So in other words, deform this picture until it's obvious that it's a surface of genus 1. So really see that the genus of our particular surface, sigma, is equal to 1. Okay. Now I can define the genus of a knot. So the genus of the knot is the minimal, so this is equal to the minimal genus of a ciphered surface for our knot. So the genus of the trefoil, let's figure out what it is. First of all, it's at most 1 because I just wrote a surface of genus 1 whose boundary is the trefoil. Okay? Could it be 0? Well, had it been 0, the trefoil would be the boundary of an embedded disk. But then it's the anode. Okay, because you can write if the trefoil was the boundary of an embedded thing like this, this is just a disk, you could just contract it through that disk to nothing. Okay? So in fact, the only knot with genus 0 is the anode. But since we've already proven that the trefoil is not the anode, it follows that the genus of the trefoil is 1. But there are other, okay, but that was a lucky case. In general, if you have a complicated knot and you find a surface of genus 3 for it, you will not know if you can also find a surface of genus 2. Okay, or you'll have to work to show that you cannot also find a surface of a lower genus. Okay? By the way, the surface, the ciphered surface is certainly not unique, and the genus of the ciphered surface is not determined by the knot. Okay, so we can speak about the minimal genus, but there are other ciphered surfaces with higher genus. So for example, I could easily take this disk and implant on top of it a little bulb with 3 holes. Okay? And now I have a surface of genus 4 whose boundary is the same as before. Okay? Okay. And then I want to state the last topological problem that we may be able to approach. And here it is. So, So definition a knot is a ribbon knot if it can be drawn in R3 so that it bounds a disk. Bounds a disk meaning just that you also have a disk in R3 whose boundary is the knot. And I should say a singular disk. If it bounds an embedded disk, then it's just the anode. So that it bounds a singular disk with only ribbon singularities. So let me explain. A ribbon singularity is something that looks like the following thing. So a piece of your disk looks like this ribbon. Another piece of your disk is this ribbon. Okay, so this could be connected somehow. And then maybe close, so that could be the whole disk. Okay? Or it could be more complicated, but at least one piece should look like, well, the two pieces should look like ribbons that cross each other in this way. So if you want the singularity will be, or the singular points will be along this line here, where the two ribbons meet. Okay? So this is a ribbon singularity. This is as opposed to a clasp singularity. So, by the way, better pictures are in your handout, drawn by Zuji a while ago. So a clasp singularity would look like this. You have your two pieces of the disk approaching each other and meeting each other this way, so that the line of singularities looks like this. Okay? So this is a so-called clasp singularity. So one can give a completely topological definition for these singularities. So let me say it quickly without writing. Okay? So first of all, to be a ribbon disk, you must have at most double point singularities. So no triple intersections of the disk with itself, or no infinite intersections of the disk with itself. At the double points, you must have transverse intersections. Okay? And then, if you look at the inverse image of the singular points back in the parameter space of the disk, so let's do it in both of these cases. So inverse images. So in the parameter space of the disk, every singular point becomes two points, right? Because it's a double point. It's a point both on this part and on this part. Okay? So for the clasp singularity, the singular set looks like, well, a line going from the boundary to the boundary, if you're viewing it from the perspective of this ribbon, so a big line like this from the perspective of the narrow ribbon, and if you're viewing it from the perspective of the wide ribbon, it's just an interval going from an inside point to another inside point. So it looks like this, and if I were to be more precise, the end points of that line of singularities are points in which the boundary of the disk intersects its interior. Okay, in other words, the knot intersects the disk. Okay? So this is the inverse image picture, the parameter space picture for ribbon singularities. For clasp singularities, well, from the perspective of the disk on the right, you start somewhere in the middle of the disk and you go to its boundary. So you start from the middle and you go to the boundary. Where you start, you're intersecting the boundary of the disk. And from the perspective of the left disk, the same. Okay, so a ribbon singularity is a singularity whose two pre-images, well, one is completely interior to the disk and the other has its boundary on the boundary of the disk. And a clasp singularity is a singularity for which the inverse image has two components, each of which has one interior point. The boundary of each of which is one interior point and one boundary point. Okay? So, one can show, and it's not very difficult, that every knot bounds a disk with clasp singularities. Okay? So if you allow clasp singularities, then every knot bounds such a disk. So do not allow this, and do allow those, and if you only allow those, your knot is a ribbon knot. Okay? So, example for a ribbon knot. So, example, the handshake knot. It's a bit hard to draw, especially if you are if you're geometrically retarded as I am. Okay, so that's the basic ingredient. Okay, you see the handshake, right? You have two hands clasping each other somehow. Well, clasping is sort of a bad word, but two hands grabbing each other, and then I complete it with the body. So this connects to here, and this connects to here, and if you wanted to make it a little prettier or a little more complicated, you could add five twists over here. Okay? Well, it's not five, but you can add the number of twists over here. Now, why is this a ribbon knot? Well, it's obvious, right? The disk is this ribbon, which kind of grows like two tennis rackets at the end. Okay, it grows bigger at the ends. The singularities are quite clear, right? You have here the ribbon dives into the pan of the other side. Okay, so where it dives, you have a singularity. Then it's behind, and then it rises, and you have another singularity here. So you have two ribbon singularities. By the way, if you were to draw the inverse images, it's kind of nice, so let's do it. So in the parameter space, here is the ribbon. And now let's start following, this is kind of side one of the ribbon, and this is side two of the ribbon. Okay? So I'll start following the ribbon from 1, 2, 2. Okay, so it means going all the way around and back. Okay? So I first meet, as I go through the ribbon, I first see singularity number 2, but I see it as an interior singularity. So I have a 2 here. Then as I continue, I go through singularity number 1, but now it's a singularity that spans the whole ribbon. Okay? So here is 1. And then as I continue going, well, all of this is not even seen in the parameter space. So then I meet singularity number 2 once again, but now as a spanning singularity, so going all the way from one end to the other end, and then I continue and I see singularity number 1 as an inside singularity. So this is singularity number 1. Okay? So this is the parameter space picture, and in the target space, this interval is identified with this, and this is identified with that. Okay? So, okay. A little theorem, the trefoil knot, and many other knots, but in particular the trefoil, is not ribbon. Okay? So what I'll do in the next hour is explain, okay, so sorry, problem number 3 will be decide if a knot is ribbon. So I've shown an example of a ribbon knot and also an example of a non-ribbon knot. And in the next hour I will show how this is related to algebraic knot theory for today. Question over here. So let's take a 10 minutes break.